between now and next week, please, will be to read the entire epistle, the 16 chapters, at a sitting. And then do it again at a later time, maybe with another translation. Read it at least through twice, so that you do with the letter what the early Christians did who received the letter. They didn't sit down and atomistically take apart the verses in exegetical treatment and so on. They just read it. Of course, they had a great advantage. They knew the Greek, and they understood the concepts of Paul very clearly. Paul had founded the congregation, had given them their basic instructions, so it was a very, very pleasant thing for them. We have to work at the Greek, as your husbands can testify, and then we make translations, and we try to recapture the understandings which came to them a little more naturally. But our point is, let's do with the letter what they did. Now, when you get a letter, you don't just read one paragraph and set it aside and go over the words and analyze what the meanings might be. You read the whole thing through. Well, that's what you're supposed to do with these biblical letters, too. So let's sort of get a general impression from the general overall reading. And maybe the second time you read it, you can follow that outline and sort of see how the chapter groupings work out. You notice that we are divided into two major parts there, the first six chapters and the remaining eight. And I'll talk a little bit later about the reason for that particular division. Then you notice you received also a sheet titled Reconstructed Sequence of Events, prior and leading to the writing of 1st and 2nd Corinthians, respectively, as suggested by the data of Acts and 1st and 2nd Corinthians. Now you've only got the sheets which are titled A there, Events Prior and Leading to the Writing of 1st Corinthians. There are companion sheets like these that are issued when we study 2nd Corinthians, but those won't be necessary for our purposes. So you only have an A, there'll be no B, because that would be a separate entry and distribution. But this will then tell about the things that happened immediately prior to Paul's writing, and we'll take that up in a little while too. Now, because some of you girls have been with me in several Pauline courses, I thought I would issue to all in this class the chronology of events in the life of St. Paul, showing, that's the third sheet, showing how we correlate the events and the writing of the letters and various things. This is just for your own study at leisure if you're interested. Not interested, file it away somewhere or give it to your hubby. Maybe he needs something like this sometime for his Bible class. But this will sort of set up a sequence. You know, we take it from different parts, mainly from Acts, and then the epistles have to fit in, and the references in the epistles to certain activities in Paul's part. Well, this will put it all together once for you. Now, I have a few minor changes I've made since these were issued, but they are not of sufficient and major consequence to dictate the changes. We hadn't have time for that. But you'll notice, as we move along on page 3, that we have the spring of 55, and there it says, Paul writes the first epistle to the Corinthians from Ephesus about Passover time. Don't read that 1-2a, that goes with the Acts 20 above there. I just looking at that for a minute, wondering what that meant. But that's really the scripture reference, which gives us that information which we supply. And then additional information, you see the second epistle is written in the late summer of 55. Well, as you're reading your Bible books and the Pauline works, I should say, you can see where they fit in his life and sort of develop a correlation between the epistolary writings and the biographical data that we're able to glean. So that's just as a matter of interest. If you want to look at that, you may do so. You have now the information at hand. The commentary that has been issued you, I see, is on both the Corinthian epistles. Oh, just the first. Just the first, yeah. By Groveside. This is the one of the New International Commentary series, NIC we abbreviate it, which is suggested because it is recent, late 1960s, or whatever the date is in there, maybe middle 1960s, but relatively recent. It is conservative. It is also reformed, so you're going to want to watch it. For example, in some parts toward the back there in chapter 11, for example, where you get to the discussion of Holy Communion, you will notice, perhaps if you do some reading there, that some reformed thought comes through rather than our Lutheran understanding of the sacrament. But there's enough thought-provoking material to sort of prime the pump for discussion, and our request is, as you come into the class, that you will have read not only the English section again that you think we're going to cover, keep about a chapter ahead of what we
stop with the night before, the previous lesson. But also then, please read what the commentary has to say on the subject. Now, your instructor will not always agree with what the commentary says. In fact, I don't think you'll find any commentary with which any professor will be in perfect agreement. Because as he studies the word and comes to a refined understanding, then there are certain differences of opinion. And especially if we're in a Lutheran tradition and that's Reformed, you will find some of those differences very quickly. But, as I say, there is enough interesting and thought-provoking material that I think it'll be useful to you to help pave the way for more thoughtful discussions when we get at these things in class. So will you also please be sure to read your commentary when you come in. And then we'll go at the work in the text, and our purpose will be simply to go as far as we can, covering as many of the chapters as we can in 1 Corinthians. There are 16, and I think we only have, what, how many nights are they going to give us? 10, maybe? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. One more. One of those nights, by the way, it just occurs to me, and I'm very grateful to report that it's only one, I will have to be gone. And that's when I'm in attendance at the Montana District Convention as a synodic representative. And I don't know what we're going to do about the night. Probably I will have another professor come in to deliver the lecture on the given spot in 1 Corinthians where we have been at that time. Maybe there's some other way we can do it, but I think probably that's the way it'll happen. Otherwise, I will hope to be with you for all of them. Well, we'll do as much of the 16 chapters as we can. We won't cover them all, so I'll be a little bit selective. But I sort of know from previous experiences, not only with the boys, but also with the students' wives, certain other sections in which they're interested. Now, we'll try to do in a relatively quick fashion the first four chapters because they're fundamental and they're the first major problem that Paul has to treat in the Corinthian correspondence. But then we'll be somewhat selective. I'm surely going to treat chapter 7, the chapter in marriage. So many people have had wrong ideas of about Paul, thinking he doesn't like ladies or something, and that's nothing to be farther from the truth. But they have misunderstood chapter 7 and some of the things that he has said there. That's usually an important one. We'll want to touch upon the Christian's use of the adiaphora, things neither forbidden nor commanded in Scripture, as chapters 8 to 10 discuss that. We'll pick out certain portions of that. We will want to touch upon woman's head covering, because that's subject to a lot of misunderstanding in 1 Corinthians 11, the first half of the chapter. The second half on Holy Communion, I think probably, unless I get some very urgent requests, I may not go into, for the simple reason that I think most of you have a pretty good understanding of the doctrine of the Lord's Supper. Should there be some reason for our taking that, I will certainly accede to your requests. Otherwise, we'll go over to chapter 13, the chapter on Christian love, the famous hymn on Christian love. And then 12 to 14 deals with the subject of the spiritual gifts. Today, sometimes they're referred to as the charismatic gifts, and I suppose some portions of those sections would be interesting to you in view of the current discussion. Probably we'll touch upon that. And then if we have a little time left, then we can go to chapter, 15, the Great Resurrection chapter of the New Testament. And the first part of 16 offers some very practical advice in the area of discharging stewardship responsibility, in the area of treasure, various rules for Christian giving, and the blessings that are attendant upon such giving. And if we accomplish all of that, we will have done our job in the 11 nights ahead. All right, now tonight we'll have to devote to some discussion of introductory matters. I want to talk a little bit to you about the city of Corinth, just a few words, a little bit about its location in history, secondly about the church at Corinth when it was founded by Paul, what we know about that church on the basis of our study of Acts and other works, and then finally the epistle itself, a few remarks about it, and if we get through that tonight, we will have accomplished our work. Now, first of all, about the city. Corinth at Paul's time was the capital of the Roman province of Achaia. If you look at modern Greece, divided in about half, well, the bottom half is what was called Achaia in those days. The top half was Macedonia. And Corinth was the capital of the southern Roman province, the province of Achaia. Situated on a narrow, I wish I could pull that down and have a map, but that's only a movie screen. I found out this afternoon I was in the same classroom. It would be so nice if we could just pull out a map and demonstrate things, but we don't quite have that luxury yet. But in the back of your Bibles, if you will look, you will see that Corinth is located on the isthmus between the Peloponnesus, that's lower Greece, that big lower protrusion, and the mainland, which is called Upper Greece. The site of the city was about a mile and a half inland from and south of the Gulf of Corinth, which lay to the west. So the body of water which lies to the west of the city of Corinth, as we look at the map, is the Gulf of Corinth. And it lies at the south end of the isthmus on an elevated terrace or plateau at the north foot of the Acrocorinth, which is a rocky hill rising to 1,886 feet above sea level. Now, if you're in Corinth, have any of you girls been over with your hubbies on those Bible Lands tours? Anybody been to Corinth? I see no hands going up. Well, you can't help us then. I have never been there, and so I was going to ask for a little assistance from someone who had seen this thing. But Corinth, the ancient Corinth, was located right at the foot of the Acrocorinth, this tall hill rising almost 2,000 feet, on top of which there was a temple to Aphrodite, which I'll talk about a little later on. But it's a mark of the area. You have the Gulf of Corinth over the west. The other gulf is called the Saronic Gulf, S-A-R-O-N-I-C. The seaport town for the Saronic Gulf, the body of water to the right that comes in like this to help form the isthmus, is Cenchrea. And by the way, Phoebe is deaconess of the Church of Cenchrea, as the 16th chapter of Romans mentions. And this is one of the chief passages the deaconess school over at Valparaiso uses to show that there were deaconesses, professional women church workers, at this early time. There are other passages we can find in the pastoral epistles, and we believe that this was an institution already at that time. But it's just interesting to note that this deaconess Phoebe was deaconess of the Church of Cenchrea, which is the seaport town, which would be then to the east of Corinth, as you look at the map, on the Saronic Gulf. The seaport town on the Gulf of Corinth to the west would be Lechium, spelled L-E-C-H-A-E-U-M or A-I-O-N, whether you have the Latin or the Greek spelling means the same thing. All right, now, having said this, it's not simply interesting geography, but it has a point. Corinth, then, you see, was a strategic location. All land traffic between the peninsula, the Peloponnesus, and the mainland was obliged to pass the town, so all north and south traffic. Furthermore, very, very much east and west traffic went through here. In fact, we're told that probably half the goods that left the east and went to the west and vice versa came to these harbors and passed right by Corinth. What they did is to take the ships, the smaller ones, right from the water and put them on logs, and they had animals pulling them on a sort of haul across, I should say, in which the ship was taken from the one seaport right past Corinth to the other and put into the water again. So about half of the commerce that passed from east to west went through this area, and all of it that went from north to south. This determined the character of the town. The people were commercially inclined because of the location. Pretty soon they became wealthy. With wealth came licentiousness and ease and luxury, all these things. And that in part determines the nature of the people that form the first congregation, and why Paul has so many problems with them. If any of you have read Corinthians, 1 Corinthians recently, you recall how you're surprised, at least I am whenever I read it, at how many things are wrong at that place, and yet Paul addresses them all as Christian brothers and sisters and regards them as members of the kingdom of God. And you wonder, well, how did they get in that shape? They had all these things wrong. Well, I think the situation of the city, and therefore that determining the type of occupation and the wealth and the luxury and so forth, certainly accounted for much of the difficulty that developed there in the congregation, which by the grace of God, Paul was able, through his visits and through his letters that he sent, to dispel. So that by the time he's made his three visits and sent his four letters, and I said four letters advisedly because two of them are referred to in the Corinthian correspondence, but have not survived. They were written and have been lost. Actually, our 1 Corinthians is Paul's second letter to Corinth, and our 2 Corinthians is his fourth letter to Corinth. And the others the Lord saw fit in his providence not to preserve. But there were four letters and three visits, and when all seven of these things have been done, Corinth is straightened out. But there's quite a bit to do when we take the matter in hand. That's before us, the study of 1 Corinthians. Okay, so Emperor Nero, we might just note in passing, visited Greece and seriously undertook the project of constructing a canal across the isthmus to save this hauling of boats across. He was not successful. Today, however, visitors tell us who have gone there, maybe you've seen it in National Geographic or in some travel folder or something if you were looking at it, there is a ship canal all the way across the isthmus there, passing by ancient Corinth, which ocean-going vessels today are able to traverse. Very narrow it is, and they can just make it, most of them, but there is a canal finally there. Now, as far as the history of the city is concerned, it goes back to about 3000 BC, they tell us, to the early Bronze Age. I won't burden you with details of the history, but it comes right down to the middle of the first millennium, let's say about 500 BC. There have been various settlers and kinds of people that dwelt there, all of them commercial, unwarlike, luxurious, licentious, no matter what group of people came to occupy the land there, they took on the same character in time after time. When you get down to about 500, it's a city of great prosperity and power. It was famed for its pottery and bronze work. Its products were carried everywhere by extensive shipping. You have a couple of wars, the Peloponnesian War, the Corinthian War, and finally, to make a long story short, after Corinth came under Macedonian rule to the north. This is Philip Macedon and Alexander the Great, 320-something B.C. Then finally the Romans take over in 196 B.C., and Greece was declared independent by the Romans. 50 years later, the city rebelled and it was razed, and it lay fallow for about 100 years. And only later, in 44 B.C., under Julius Caesar, Corinth was refounded as a Roman colony, ruled by a proconsul, and it became then the capital of the Roman province of Achaia, as we described it a short time ago. The city was named Corinth in honor of its new founder, a certain Colonia Laus Julia Corinthiensis, a name found in an inscription at Corinth. The colonists were apparently freedmen from Italy, with whom Greeks and Orientals, including many Jews, soon then mingled. And once again, the old cycle returned. You have prosperity, luxury, licentiousness. Corinth was famous at this time for the, at Paul's time, let's say, for the Isthmian Games, one of the chief attractions. We just went through the Olympian Games. We all watched the Olympic Games on television. And the Greeks at this time had the games there at Olympus and at Corinth and a few other places. Well, the Corinthian Games were a very great sports attraction. Brought a lot of people to the city, a lot of money again, and furthered the commerce and the industry there. Corinth was never famous for its philosophers like Athens was, but these people were always busy with their hands making things and making a lot of money. Its forte was trade and the arts. It was famous for Corinthian brass, Corinthian capitals and pillars, you know, you see them on the houses yet today, and that type of thing. Now, just a word about the licentiousness and so on, to which the this cycle of becoming prosperous and wealthy and idle and at ease, and then in connection with this licentious led the people at various times in their history. In Paul's time, on the summit of the Acro Corinth, this tall hill, there was this great temple built to Aphrodite. In Greek mythology, she is the goddess of love and beauty. In the Roman pantheon, that's the same as Venus, who is the same kind of goddess of love and beauty, in which 1,000 women were kept, female slaves, free to strangers. These were temple prostitutes. And Strabo, the historian, points out that the worship of this goddess brought many people and much wealth to Corinth. Here, then, we see that immorality was consecrated. The sailors would hit town and get off their ships, and they wanted to go to worship. And that was a regular procedure there, and you know, of course, what that involves. The immoral life in Corinth gave rise and meaning later on, especially after 44 BC, to a verb which we would translate today to Corinthianize, which means to have a consort with prostitutes. To be a Corinthian meant to live the profligate life, one who was abandoned to vice and who was dissolute. So when Paul later on in the epistle in the sixth chapter has to warn the Christians yet not to have concourse with the prostitutes in the city, you have a little understanding of what this is all about when you see the background from which these people emerged. Then beside the temple of Aphrodite up there in the Acro-Corinth, you also have a sanctuary to Asclepius, the god of healing. Also, there were several temples devoted to various other deities and some of the Phoenician deities. And people from Alexandria in Egypt came over and used these for their worship. Now, that gives you a little idea of the history of this place, its location, its character in general. Let's get down now to the church and some of the things we know from the book of Acts about the founding of Christian work in this noted, I guess you would even call it a cesspool of iniquity at this time in antiquity. Well, we have the establishment of this church on Paul's second missionary journey. You can see in that Pauline chronology we issued to you when you get home, if you care to look at it, just where we have Paul coming there. The dates of that second missionary journey are from the spring of 49 to the late fall of 51 A.D. Those dates occur on those sheets. And the events are related in Acts 1540 to 1822. These are the events connected with the founding of the church on Paul's second missionary journey. We'd like to ask you, please, additionally, to read Acts 1540 to 1822, where in the book of Acts there is recited the information there pertaining to Corinth that will be of interest and helpful background for our study as we move along. There we're told that Paul was in Troas over in Asia Minor, expecting to go another direction, but then he received that famous vision, come over and help us. And he leaves Asia Minor, and the summons us to the European continent, and thank God Paul went there and planted the gospel banner, because I think most of our forefathers came from Europe, and because our ancestors were made Christians by the grace of God, this was passed down through the generations until lo and behold, we are members of Christ's people and we're gathered here studying Christ's word tonight. That was the first Christian missionary work done on the European continent, the second missionary journey when Paul left Troas after seeing the vision and he'll follow the Macedonian call to come over. Well, he lands in Macedonia and tends to the cities up there first. He goes through Samothracia, Neapolis, Philippi, Amphipolis, Apollonia, Thessalonica, and Berea. Sounds like a railroad timetable. But you can see those all on your maps and see how he came across to the north first, and then he went south to Achaia. First the work in the north and the south. He went to Athens before he came to Corinth, but finally then lands in Corinth. And what actually happened in Corinth is recounted in Acts 18:1-18. And what do we learn here? Well, in the 11th verse, we read that Paul remained in Corinth 1.5 years after having arrived there at the end of 49 under the beginning of 50 A.D. So from January of 50, let's say, to about June of 51. So you see, we have a little checkpoint, a little chronological checkpoint there. Paul was there 1.5 years. Incidentally, Paul spending more time there at Corinth than at any other European church. There's only one other church in which Paul spent more time than this. This was at Ephesus on the third missionary journey, where he spent 3 years. Part of this, possibly, however, in prison. All right, so he was there 1.5 years, we learn. In 18:1-3, we learn that Paul found the Jew Aquila and his wife Priscilla there. They had been expelled from Rome by Claudius, the Roman emperor, in 49 A.D., and Paul stayed and worked with them because they were tent makers, and they become fast friends. Paul mentions Aquila and Priscilla a number of times in various epistles hereafter. In Acts 18:4-6, Paul began his missionary ministry in the Jewish synagogue there in Corinth, attempting to persuade the Jews and the Greeks, that is, the proselytes of the gate, to accept the Christian gospel. Now, Jewish proselytes, I think you're familiar with that term. There are two kinds of proselytes, converts to Judaism, that is. One kind is called proselyte of the gate, the other is proselyte of righteousness. A proselyte of righteousness is one who became a Jew all the way, submitting even to circumcision, following all the Jewish feasts and customs, and observing the Sabbath, and the various things that belong to the Jewish ceremonial and religious law. The proselyte of the gate was a Gentile who became a Jew as far as the chief elements of his faith and conviction are concerned. He accepted God's law and God's gospel, the messianic promises of the Old Testament, but did not follow with all facets of the ceremonial law, did not submit to circumcision and things of that type. And so there were the two types of proselytes. These are the proselytes of the gate. Incidentally, notice that it was Paul's standard operational procedure in coming to a new area to seek out the Jewish headquarters, whether that was a synagogue or, as in Philippi, whether the Jews went down to the riverbank to worship. They weren't numerous enough and sufficient wealth to put up a synagogue. whatever the Jewish headquarters might be in a given locale, Paul sought it out, because his SOP, standard operational procedure, was always to bring to the Jews the gospel message initially. Now, if they accepted it, then the Jewish synagogue, or whatever it was, would become headquarters of the evangelistic operation in that area. If, as frequently happened, they rejected the counsel of God against themselves, would not accept Paul and his message and the fulfillment he preached in Christ for all the messianic promises, then he would shake the dust off his feet, and then he'd find a Gentile's place and move in there. Well, Paul starts out here with the Jewish synagogue, attempting to persuade the Jews and the Greeks, which are these proselytes of the gate. When they opposed themselves and blasphemed, so he was not successful in winning the Jews here in Corinth, you notice, at least most of them, then Paul left the synagogue, this was early in his Corinthian ministry, and went to the Gentiles. And a division of the synagogue congregation takes place at this point. A number of the Jews who did believe on him, in his message that is, then went with him to the Gentile headquarters. 7 to 11 of chapter 18 point out that Paul then immediately moved to the house of a Titus Justus, a Roman citizen, no doubt a proselyte of the gate, who was now converted to Christianity, which adjoined the synagogue, so it's the house right next door. When the division and move came, one of the rulers of the synagogue, Crispus, came along with Paul, so one of the rulers of the synagogue, so one of the dignitaries, and with the others to Justus's house. And Paul at this point needed a little encouragement. God tells him not to fear. He has many people in this place. And then the information is given that Paul is going to remain there for a year and a half. Then in verses 12 to 17 of chapter 18 of Acts, the famous so-called Gallio incident takes place, which is very important for the development of a Pauline chronology. I hold that this took place in the spring of 51 AD. Gallio was the proconsul of Achaia. In 1909, a whitish-gray limestone inscription from the quarries near Delphi was found, fragmentarily perpetuating a letter from the Emperor Claudius to the citizens of Delphi. In it, Gallio is mentioned and designated Lucius Junius Gallio and referred to as my friend and proconsul of Achaia. Furthermore, the inscription's date is indicated, and just to tell you how funny this sounds, it's the 12th tribunician year of Claudius for the 26th time acclaimed imperator. Now, we don't care what that means. The only point is that the scholars of this period can take this information and establish an AD dating. And I have adopted 51. The only question is this date at the beginning of Gallio's reign or at the end? And you'll either be 51 or 52, depending on how you take this. But we're right in the same ballpark. You can see how close we are. And after the date is established, then we know at what time Gallio, in our AD reckoning, was the proconsul of Achaia. It was for 1 year. And we say that Gallio must have been almost certainly the proconsul at Corinth, either from 51 to 52 or 52 to 53. I operate for 51 to 52 and suggest that this took place at the beginning of his proconsulship when he came there. The incident taking place then shortly after he had become proconsul in the spring or summer of 51 AD. Now, the reason I mention this is that very frequently, unfortunately, we have the so-called intersections of sacred and secular history. You see, we can't just from reading the Bible establish datings, but if the Bible will refer to events which are also referred to in secular history for which we can establish a dating, well, at the point of the intersection, we can give a date because we've established it from the annals of secular history. We also know when Felix and Festus over there in Caesarea, who kept Paul in that imprisonment after his third missionary journey, recall, when they were the rulers at that time, successively one after the other, we put together chronological references like he spent a year and a half here, or he spent 3 months in Thessalonica. We estimate, that as scholars have done this, the traveling time, whether by foot, whether by boat, they've taken boats about the size of the boats that plied the Mediterranean at that time and traveled with the wind, put up sails, and they figure the traveling time, whether it's by sea lanes or by a land route, and they can very, very nearly establish a very correct Pauline chronology. You take the references to time within the document, you note the itinerary and the mode of travel and all these things and put them together, and then you're able to establish a chronology. The only place where you find the chronologies differing somewhat is depending on whether you can be a year apart on the Galileo incident, whether you say that he began at 51 or he began at 52. Well, you opt. You simply make a decision with the best light you have at a given time. The next scholar may say 52 and be just as right that I am. What you finally do is simply adopt one system and put it down on paper. That's what I've done there. And stick with it, because nobody's going to prove you're right or wrong finally. And all these chronologies that are developed are in the same ballpark anyway, only a year or two apart on these various events. But it sort of gives you an idea of the time interval and the span of the Pauline activity, the length of the missionary journeys, and things of that type, which I think are all useful when you're trying to better understand the Pauline work. All right, then Paul remained in Corinth a little while after the Gallio incident. You can read what that incident was, how they wanted to punish Paul and the others, but Gallio being impartial, and there was sort of a religious a toleration operative at the time, said, no, he hasn't broken any law, and they didn't go out after Paul and so on. That's an interesting thing, and I hope that you will read that. But Paul remains a little while after the Gallio incident. Then he departs from Corinth about the summer of 51, goes to Cenchrea, crosses over to Ephesus by ship, and then back to Caesarea, Jerusalem, and winters in Antioch. The next time we pick up Paul and the contact of Paul with Corinth is on the third missionary journey now. And this is recounted in Acts 18:23-21:15. That's the account in Acts of the third missionary journey. And the events of the journey cover a four-year period from the spring of 52 to the spring of 56 A.D., as your outlines will have shown you. And he was in Corinth the three winter months this time, from December of 55 to February of 56. Now, how he got there was this way. He first of all passed, as he began his third missionary journey in the spring of 52, through the country of Galatia and Phrygia, came to Ephesus, where he spent about 3 years. Then he left for the north through Macedonia, came around to Philippi, Thessalonica, Berea, those towns that he had founded on the second journey, those churches, and then came down to Corinth, where he spent the winter, probably December of 55 to February of 56. And then he returns by way of Macedonia, sailing from Philippi to Troas to Miletus and home. Now, what do we know about Paul's activities and his associates during this period? Well, by the time Paul began his third missionary journey, we know that Aquila and Priscilla, who had been left by Paul at Ephesus, were still at this city. And when Paul, this is Acts 18:23-19:1, was moving through Galatia and Phrygia on his way to Ephesus, there was an Alexandrian Jew by the name of Apollos, another name we want to become familiar with, who came to Ephesus at this time. Aquila and Priscilla heard him speak in the synagogue and expounded unto him, we read, the way of God more perfectly. And that means that Aquila and Priscilla took him aside and said, look, you have a tremendous knowledge of the Old Testament. You're doing a great job with these Jews here in the synagogue as you're arguing for the messianic promises and so on. But we're here to tell you that those promises have been fulfilled in the person and the work of Jesus of Nazareth, and then they would give him all the details. And Paulus was Christianized in that way by these faithful lay people whom Paul had met on the second missionary journey over there in Corinth. Now they're in Ephesus. And before they get there, this Jew Apollos had come over. Well, Apollos desired to travel over to Achaia, as many of his fellows from Alexandria had done. There was a direct ship route from Alexandria of Egypt, right across the Mediterranean, north, and to the area of Corinth. And as I said, many of those seamen worshipped the Egyptian deities. They had a temple to Egyptian deities there too. And so he had heard a lot about Corinth. He wanted to see this city. His evangelical testimony there to the Jews in Corinth helped the Corinthians, their believers there, greatly. Well, Paul completes his 3-year stay in Ephesus. He starts about the spring of 52 when he gets there to the spring of 55. He has had his 3 months in the synagogue there and departs for the school of a certain Tyrannus. He reasons in the school of Tyrannus for 2 years, we read in chapter 19, verse 10. And then he probably has his imprisonment, during which time he writes the four so-called captivity epistles, letters written while Paul was captured, while he was in prison. And these are Philippians, Philemon, Ephesians, and Colossians. And we feel that they were written during the time of his imprisonment. And then finally we come at the end of the three-year period, when he's released from prison, to the spring of 55, when Paul will write the first epistle to the Corinthians, anticipating his coming later in the year. He'll winter there by December of 55, but before he gets there, he writes this first letter. Now, I think this is the point at which we would well take in hand the sheet titled A Reconstructed Sequence of Events Relating to Paul and the Corinthians, prior and leading to the writing of 1 Corinthians. And let's go down these step by step. By the way, if your hubby's having their library, a book by Martin Frontzman, Word of the Lord Grows, which is a book on New Testament introduction, I think you would find it very useful and profitable reading to read the section on Paul's relation to Corinth and the things that pertain to the writing of 1 Corinthians there. You can go on to 2 Corinthians 2 if you're interested. But let's see what happened just prior to the writing of 1 Corinthians. We're sort of honing in now and magnifying an area which we just skipped over very quickly a moment ago. Paul, after release from a posited Ephesian imprisonment, which ended perhaps in 54 or early 55, probably makes a promised trip to Colossae immediately to visit Philemon. That this trip was soon to be made is indicated in that one chapter epistle to Philemon in verses 21 to 22. Now, Paul in Ephesus, probably before, I would say, you can scratch out the or after, probably before his release from imprisonment, had heard about certain aberrations in Christian life and church practices, probably from Chloe's people, who are mentioned in 1 Corinthians 1:11, in Corinth. So Paul is in prison in Ephesus, and some people bring him information about what's going on in Corinth, since the congregation was established on the second missionary journey. Paul's on the third in prison now. And this information was most likely conveyed by Chloe's people, servants of the household or so, who reached Paul in Ephesus. He was probably under house arrest, and communicated this to him. In reaction, he wrote a letter, now lost, which is referred to in 1 Corinthians 5:9. When you read 1 Corinthians 5:9, you will note at that passage that Paul refers to a letter he has previously written. Now, our first letter to the Corinthians is 1 Corinthians. But in our 1 Corinthians, he refers to a letter he wrote to them before, which is the real 1 Corinthians, evidently, ours being the second. We don't use that terminology, it would be confusing. But there has been a letter written before. Its specific demand was that the Corinthians refused to have fellowship with immoral men. It might have been Chloe's people who delivered this earlier letter of Paul's to Corinth. So he'd heard about a problem there, they're consorting with immoral people, and he writes a letter to sort of nip that thing in the bud. The congregation's already established, it's been there, the basic instruction is out, but here's an aberration that has developed, and that letter was supposed to take care of it. Number three, these same people of Chloe's would then have seen how Paul's letter, now lost, was received in Corinth, and could report this to Paul. This they no doubt did, as is suggested in 1 Corinthians 1:11. They specifically informed Paul that the church had broken up into factions over the issues involved. And Paul will treat that whole matter in the first four chapters, the matter of the factions that developed in Corinth, in the first four chapters of this of our 1 Corinthians. It was probably they also who reported to the apostle the conditions resulting from the Christ party's promulgation. Now there are four parties in Corinth, the Paul party, the Apollos party, the Peter party, or Cephas party, and the Christ party. We'll be talking about those two. But just to bring in the reference here to the Christ party, there are four of them there, and here's one of them. Conditions resulting from the Christ party's promulgation of the new absolute liberty teaching. That seems to be reflected in 1 Corinthians 5 and 6, in which Paul deals with that aberration. For example, in 1 Corinthians 5, you have the story of one man's living incestuously with his stepmother. And then the congregation's arrogant toleration of the situation and the breakdown of church discipline in this connection. Well, all of that's treated in 1 Corinthians 5, and Paul says, now shape up. Then you have the fact that differences between members were no longer being settled within the congregation, but in court. And Paul deals this matter of Christians going to law with Christians before pagan courts, saying it ought not to be in 1 Corinthians 6:1 and following. In other words, the first half of 1 Corinthians 6. And then we come in the second half of the chapter to Paul's dealing with the New Liberty teachings, positing the propriety of association with prostitutes, and Paul has to X that one out, but fast and firmly, in 6:12 to 20. Now, number four, Paul's concern over the existence of divisions in the Corinthian congregation and the moral problems prompts him to send Timothy to Corinth at once, but by way of Macedonia, that's to the north, instead of the direct ship route from Ephesus in Asia Minor, south and west to Corinth. He's going to go north via those churches to the north in Macedonia and then travel by land down to Corinth. All right. So he dispatches Timothy, but by way of Macedonia. And he wants Timothy to remind the church of the God-pleasing ways of behavior taught by Paul. And that he is sending Timothy is indicated in 1 Corinthians 4, 16 and 17, and 16, 10 to 11, where this very fact is mentioned. You can immediately gather from this that after he has dispatched Timothy, Paul writes this letter so that it will reach the Corinthians before Timothy arrives. Now, why is that so? What happened? Well, the next will tell us. Number five. There were those in Corinth, too, however, who questioned and objected to a number of the liberal teachings and practices. Men like Stephanus, Fortunatus, and Achaicus. And these counseled consultation with the Apostle Paul on questions raised by the new theology of freedom. The congregation, therefore, wrote Paul a letter which presented inquiries on points regarding which the teachings of the new theology were notably divergent from those of Paul. These questions concerned marriage, and Paul will deal with that in 1 Corinthians 7. The matter of Christians eating food offered in sacrifice to idols, Paul handles that in 1 Corinthians chapters 8 to 10. Spiritual gifts with which the Christians were endowed, Paul treats that in 1 Corinthians 12 to 14. There was also a question regarding the forthcoming collection for the Jerusalem saints, and Paul deals with that in 1 Corinthians 16. Now, the delegation of Stephanus, Fortunatus, and Achaicus arrived in Ephesus, perhaps shortly after Timothy's departure, delivered the letter from Corinth to Paul, and provided him with further information on the Corinthian situation, with more, perhaps, on the matters reported by Chloe's people, with some facts regarding the malpractice in the worship life of the church, namely some women's lack of head covering at worship and disorders connected with the observance of fellowship meals and of the Lord's Supper. All of that's handled by Paul in 1 Corinthians 11. And with news of the heresy voiced by some that there was no resurrection from the dead, and Paul has to handle that one in the entire 15th, the great resurrection chapter of the New Testament. So then now, in response to these three sources of information, in the spring of 55 A.D., number 7, Paul then writes 1 Corinthians, as he had learned about the Corinthian situation from Chloe's people, from the delegation from Corinth, these three men, and from the letter sent by the Corinthian church to Paul, which these three men also bore. He also desires to inform the Corinthians of Timothy's imminent arrival in their midst, the purpose of that visit, the reception he ought to receive, and of his own plans to visit Corinth in the near future. Then we would have in the next subsequent event, subsequent to the sending of 1 Corinthians and prior to the writing of 2nd, but that's not our interest at this point. So, while Paul is in the Ephesian imprisonment, he receives some information on problems in Corinth, dispatches a letter, now lost, which is supposed to clear it up. Unfortunately, it doesn't, and Chloe's people report back. They have to talk about a continuing immorality and problem along that line, plus factions that have developed, four parties, plus this incestuous relationship that a young fellow has contracted with his father's wife. We hope it's his stepmother, not his own mother. I think we must put the best construction on that. And that's part of the thing that Paul wants to handle. And the letter comes from Corinth, and the reason we know a letter has been sent is at the beginning of chapter 7, chapter 8, chapter 12, and 16 in the Greek, we have a phrase which says, now concerning the things of which you wrote. And that gives us our clue that what Paul says in those chapters are in response to the matters brought up in the letter. And then we have a little left over, the stuff in chapter 11 and the stuff in chapter 15, and we simply say, well, probably it was the delegation of these three men itself then that communicated the information on these subjects, which Paul then proceeded to treat in his epistle. If you take the outline in hand, you can see how the outline follows this very closely. It's very brief, and I'll be giving more details for the outline as we move along. This is just the major divisions. You notice we have two major divisions here. Paul's comments with reference to the conditions in the Corinthian congregation as reported by Chloe's people. And the first six chapters deal with that. The factions, the first four, congregation toleration of the incestuous person in five, members going to court with members, 6:1 to 11, and was misapplication of the principle of Christian freedom, particularly in the matter of fornication, consorting with harlots, that's 6:12-20. Now that Paul's response to the information he most likely got from Chloe's people. But then he has the two other sources of information, and Paul deals with that in the second part of the epistle. He replies to the Corinthians' questions as presented in their letter to him. Together with this, interspersed comments on additional aspects of the deteriorating spiritual situation, as Paul had learned of these probably from the Corinthian delegation. The balance of the epistle deals with these. Now, where you have replied to the question, and you see it's in A, D, F, A, B, D, and F, where the word reply occurs, that refers to Paul's response to matters which the Corinthians have presented in their letter. Where I have then comment on in C and response in E, in personal matters, then the comment and the response refer probably to matters that were brought to Paul's attention by the delegation. Okay.